The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So it kind of a little bit happened by chance that I started giving a series of talks on Monday night on the Four Noble Truths. And so this tonight will be the fourth one on the Fourth Noble Truth. And for those of you who might not have been here, just mention briefly that the Four Noble Truths can be seen as the core teaching of Buddhism, and that all the important teachings of Buddhism are expression of it, come out of it, reflect back on it. And that the Four Noble Truths can seem relatively simple to understand, but to really use them to penetrate deeply into our lives is a phenomenal undertaking. So the simplicity of them should not belie the profundity of them and how they can really transform our lives. In the last days, I've been meeting with people who have carried with them suffering for years. And there was a person who for 15 years was angry with a spouse and was very reluctant to give up the anger. And a big part of our meeting was to talk about the reluctance. That's a long time, 15 years. Especially if you live with someone, see them every day. I mean. And someone else who had maybe longer anger, resentment towards a ex-partner, ex-spouse, and was taking a shower and once again thinking about this resentment. And it finally dawned that the resentment was causing a lot of harm to the resentee. And seeing that, the person was able to let go of the resentment after, I don't know, 15, 20, it seemed like a very long time. And then someone told me today that she was at a meeting or at an event that all these good things were happening to other people and not to her. And somehow she wasn't part of the good things happening. And she started getting angry and resentful towards them, towards the universe, towards herself. And why were they getting all the goodies and not her? Something like this. And she said that at some point in the middle of it, she said, "I don't have to do this. This is a phenomenal waste of time to be focusing on me here. And why don't I just focus on these people having, you know, having success and celebrating their happiness and well-being?" And see, she turned around on her on a dime, and she just started feeling really happy. And she said it was kind of like walking with shoes that had a pebble in them. And it finally occurred to her to take out the pebble. In her situation, it was focusing on, you know, referring everything back to herself and feeling herself left out or hurt or ignored or something. It's quite something how long people can hold on to something, to belief, to feelings, to emotions, to opinions, to sense of self, ideas of self, that can take a lifetime, you know, years and years to release. I had the audacity to, recently to tell someone that he was selfish. I didn't know if that was safe. Can I really say that? I don't know, I'm not well. And he kind of relaxed and he said, "You're right." So, you know, it's easy to see in other people that how much they can suffer, burn, when they cling and hold on to something. I met someone also recently who was holding on to a variety of things that was set in place when, as a child, in the relationship with the mother. Something that was played itself out in unhealthy ways as an adult. So it's kind of easy to see in other people. It's very hard to see sometimes in ourselves. Or it's hard to see how subtle and deep and tenacious it is what we hold on to. And how what we hold on to burns us, causes tremendous amount of suffering and pain. In these series of Four Noble Truth Talks, I tried in the most of the series, I believe, if I remember what I did, to point out that the Four Noble Truths are amazingly simple and ordinary truths that take, you know, I had, you know, ordinary examples like, you know, what do you do when you see the traffic light is turning yellow? And do you cling at that moment or do you let go? And you have happiness or ease, or you're tight, just in that little subtle ordinary thing of the traffic light. I did that, I tried to make it as ordinary as possible, the Four Noble Truths, to show how an ordinary part of our life it is, to kind of perspective to have. But I didn't really convey much these last three talks, how these Four Noble Truths apply to some of the most difficult and forms of suffering and distress that people have in their lives. And they're meant to be medicine for that. They're kind of meant to be this wonderful medicine that we can apply to our lives and help release us from what we hold on to and cling to and resist, and the way our hearts are closed, our hearts are broken. So the Four Noble Truths are meant to be not philosophical truths, like a creed that you have to believe in, like this is the truth, but rather they are pragmatic truths, like the truth that it's kind of a truth that if you cut yourself, you should keep the wound clean, otherwise it might not heal properly. And we usually don't say this is a truth, you know, the truth of cleaning of healing, but you need to have, you know, it's kind of a truth there. So the Four Noble Truths are pragmatic truths in that way. And they're truths that have to do with if you suffer, if you have a wound, if you suffer, these are the useful things to keep in mind that are fitting, that are appropriate to help you most easily and most straightforwardly free you from that suffering. And it's kind of interesting to say it that way, the simplest and most direct way to do it. It might not be the easiest, but there, human beings have a phenomenal capacity to come up with amazingly creative belief systems. And some of them are amazingly convoluted and developed and require a tremendous amount of supernatural belief and metaphysical theorizing and all kinds of stuff. And at the genesis of many of them is a human being who suffers, who's trying to cope with their life. And they make this amazing philosophy, understanding, to try to figure out how to cope. And what I find quite remarkable about the Buddha, he was trying to do the same thing, but he kind of cut through a lot of the complexity and philosophy and metaphysics and supernatural things to really cut through. This is a simple thing. And the core essential teaching, what was unique to the Buddha, was his teachings of the Four Noble Truths. So the first truth is the truth of suffering. And it's just simply a truth that says that if you want to become free of your suffering, you should notice it. You know, maybe it doesn't sound like a good idea. I've known people who've gotten angry when they were told they should turn and look at their suffering. What do you mean, look at it? I'll just suffer more. The whole purpose here is to get away from it, not to suffer. You tell me the truth. So the first truth is it's useful to notice that you're suffering. It's useful to notice you have that pebble in your shoe before it digs a big hole in your foot. The second noble truth has to do with noticing what it is that's the cause of that suffering. What's the genesis of it? What's the condition that prompts it to be there? And it's a little bit of a circular argument in this way, that the suffering that Buddhism is addressing is a suffering that arises out of the cause that Buddhism names. So the cause that the Buddha named as the cause of suffering is craving. Compulsive desire. Desire that you can't easily put down, that drives you, that runs your life. And it could also be a kind of resistance, it's a kind of craving. And so the suffering that Buddhism addresses is that suffering that arises out of craving. Maybe there's suffering that doesn't come out of craving. So with Buddhism, then you're left with that. So for example, someone you know, you love, dies, and there's sadness. Or your back goes out and it hurts. There's a variety of things that might be conventionally seen, that's unfortunate, it's kind of painful, that's suffering. But suffering that Buddhism, so it's a circular thing in Buddhism, the suffering Buddhism addresses is the suffering that comes from craving. Therefore they can say, what's the cause of suffering? Craving. So that's important to understand, otherwise you're going to argue with Buddhism. What do you mean, that's all? And then the third noble truth is this good news, that it's not necessary to stay stuck in your suffering, in your clinging. It's possible to cease, to stop, to end. And then the fourth noble truth, the topic of tonight, is the Eightfold Path. And this is the Eightfold Path that we cultivate so that we can release our clinging. It's not easy sometimes to let go of clinging, and so sometimes we need to create a strong foundation on which to release it. And it's called a path, and I think it's quite significant that it's called a path. It's a metaphor of the old days when people walked a lot. They walked in paths. And so it's a metaphor where you have to walk yourself. It's not a train. It's not a plane. It's not like, you buy a ticket and get on there and someone else drives you. It's something you have to walk yourself. And it's a silly thing I like to say, you can't have people pee for you. You've got to do it yourself. So there's some things you have to do for yourself, and so walking the path, because clinging, grasping, is something that's so personal that it's something you have to kind of really find a way to free yourself from. And so how do we do it when it's difficult? Well, we set up the conditions that make it possible. And so the conditions that really support that are called the Eightfold Path. And so I'll go through them quickly and then go through them kind of more carefully. So each part of the path is labeled right. So there's right. First one is like right view, it's called. Second one is right intention. And the right here throws people off because, again, it sounds like, if people are used to kind of religious language, it's like, it's like the one and only true right, way of being. But the spirit or the understanding of this right here, it's kind of like the same idea as that if you need to do some kind of work with a tool, you want to have the right tool. It isn't like this is the true, absolute, eternal, tool you go around and use in every situation. But rather, if you have a certain task that you want to do, there is an appropriate tool for that task. So the word right here means like appropriate or suitable or fitting. But that's interesting also to use that because it's appropriate. When you use the word appropriate, it also implies a purpose. So we have to have a clear sense of purpose, what we're about, what we're doing. And if the purpose is to become free of suffering, if that's your interest, then these are the appropriate ways of living that allows that purpose to be fulfilled. And this is also a very important point in Buddhism, is that Buddhism places no one under any obligation to walk this path. There's no deity, external force, you know, some larger metaphysical principle that says, thou shalt be a Buddhist, thou shalt become free of suffering, thou shalt follow a full path. The spirit is more, if you happen to be a person who is interested in freedom from suffering, then you probably would be interested in knowing what the appropriate tools are for doing that. And you probably, if that's what you want, then you want to, you know, live accordingly. You know, so for example, if you want to learn French, you know, you probably don't go and study Swahili. That would, you know, that probably wouldn't be appropriate. What's the appropriate thing to do if you want to learn French? You take a French class. So there's appropriate things to do for different tasks. So the appropriate thing for the four noble, for being from free of suffering are these eight right steps. So there's right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So so I'll go through them. So right view is interesting because right view has to... The first two, right view and right intention, have to do with the general approach and general understanding about what we're doing here. Right speech, action, and livelihood have to do with our larger behavior, how we live in the world in a visible way. The last three, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration, have to do with what we do with our minds, our inner life, the training of it, the changing of it, transforming of it. And so, first we need to have some general understanding of what we're doing. If you don't have some general understanding, you know, how are you going to do something? If you want to build a bridge, but you don't have a large bridge, and you have no general understanding of engineering, the whole principles of bridge building, you won't be able to do it. So you have to have some general understanding of what's about. And you and not only have to understand it, but you have to also have some sense of what's the right way of approaching when you start that endeavor. So the first right view has to do with the understanding. And the key thing here is understanding the Four Noble Truths. Understanding that's at the heart of what we're trying to do. It makes our life a lot simpler, as I said earlier, to use that as the framework to understand our challenges, our suffering. The Four Noble Truths, again, are not truths, but they're more like frameworks. The perspectives to use to help us make sense of this life, make sense of our suffering, that simplifies it and helps us try to get to really the core issue. Not beliefs, metaphysics, not blame, but rather taking responsibility for the way that we cling, how we grasp, how we hold on, what we do. So that's the perspective, is the right understanding. We're here to be free of suffering, and we have to understand, if that's what we want, then these are the understanding, that the approach, the perspective we want to bring to our experience. And this is very significant because many people bring a different perspective. The person today who said she really was changed, and I knew this person for a long time, it was very significant that she would go from being resentful and angry about other people celebrating and having a good time about something they did, to realizing that she was angry because she was focusing on herself and was a waste of time. There's a very strong tendency for people to use, to look at their suffering from the perspective of their self-identity. What Buddhism suggests, or the Buddha suggested, it is not useful, if you want to try to understand suffering, to look at it from a self-centered point of view, or to look at it from the point of view of our self-image or self-identity. But rather, you can go more directly and deeply into the whole topic if you put self aside and underneath your self-image, look at where's the clinging, where's the grasping that's going on. So to use the Four Noble Truths as right view is a radical thing for people who are used to using the view of me, myself, and mine for understanding their experience. So right view. So with that as the view, if you want to become free of suffering, that this is the right perspective to have, then if you want to walk that path to be able to do that, you need to do that with a certain kind of approach, a certain kind of attitude. Without the right attitudes, certain activities we do in life are very hard to do. So, for example, if you want to help a child go to bed, sleep at night, you don't kind of go around stomping around the house belligerently angry at politicians. That's not the right approach to help your kid go to sleep. You know, if you want your kid to go to sleep, you kind of approach, you kind of calm down, slow down, you kind of, this is the time to kind of, you know, be settled yourself, approach and soothe, reassure them that things are good and you love them and something, and then they kind of settle and relax and they can go to sleep. So I can go on and on about, many different places, many different activities call for a certain approach. What occurs to me as I'm sitting here now is all these stories that I grew up with as a Buddhist, my Buddhist upbringing, about in Japan, when you went to study with a Zen master, when study with some great craftsperson who had kind of a spiritual teacher. The first, 5 years of your training, mostly what you had to do was, clean the spittoon or, sweep the house or, just do something very different. But you had to kind of do this kind of very simple menial thing, partly until you had understood the right attitude to approach the activity. In particular, you have to learn to drop your self-centeredness. Because as long as you're self-centered, you weren't really a receptacle to be able to learn what was going to be taught. And it's hard to let go of our self-centeredness, our greed for self and what's in it for me. And so, at least in some spiritual traditions, you're not even taught until you can kind of change your approach and not be so greedy or selfish for what you're trying to do in this spiritually. So in the Eightfold Path, they talk about what's the right approach or the right attitude to have as we start this path. And what I think is significant is the attitude is an attitude that's aligned with the whole purpose of being on this path. If the purpose is to become free of suffering, to have this freedom and peace, then the approach is to live with an attitude that's aligned or in harmony with that peace. So hostility, for example, is not aligned, is not in harmony with the goal of peace. Cruelty is not aligned with the goal of peace. Selfish desire is not aligned with the goal of peace. So you want to, to some degree that you can, to whatever degree you can that's reasonable, you want to kind of begin changing your attitude. And can you have an attitude that is kind, friendly, an attitude of compassion? Can you have an attitude of maybe contentment with your life, with what you have, so you're not driven by greed? The core one that the Buddhist tradition points to is sensual desire, to begin letting up a little bit on the drive for sexual satisfaction. Nothing wrong with it, but it's one that a lot of people burn with. Maybe not of you anymore, but especially when you have to think back when you were younger. Well, I don't want to assume anything. To begin practicing, contentment or kind of letting up, renunciation. And it isn't, again, meant to be, moralistic. It's not meant to be punitive. It's not meant to diminish us. But it's more like, if what you want to do is live a peaceful life free of this inner burning, being burnt up, what's the attitudes we can have in our life that are in harmony with that? And this idea of being friendly is considered paramount in Buddhism, really important. If you want to become free of suffering, start being friendly, practicing loving kindness. If you want to be free of suffering, have compassion for others and their suffering and live accordingly. So, we're not expected to do this well, but we begin kind of turning ourselves. Some people would like to be enlightened, but they don't want to have to change. So that doesn't work, The price of awakening, the price of liberation, the price of deep peace is actually quite steep, quite high. Generally we have to somehow let go of some of the things that we cherish very deeply, we hold on to and cling to quite tenaciously. So then we begin walking the path. With the right this approach, we begin walking the path. And so the first step here is looking at how we speak. It's hard to be mindful of speech, but it's assumed that it's easier to pay attention to our speech, our external speech, what we say out loud in our mouth, than what we say to ourselves in our minds. And so we supposedly have more control over there, because you can always hold your tongue. You can't necessarily hold your mind, but you don't have to speak oftentimes. So there's the idea is to start looking at your speech. And can you speak in such a way that it's in harmony with the purpose that you have? And if the purpose, again, is to be free of suffering, how would you speak if that's really your goal? if we honestly look at how we speak and what motivates our speaking, you'll probably see that some of the speaking we do itself contains within it suffering, or the seeds of suffering, clinging. How much of our speaking is self-centered? How much of it is manipulative? How much of it has to do with holding on to something that we really want and crave and need? How much of our talking is ways of presenting ourselves to the world, protecting ourselves from the world, arranging for something to happen? How many people lie? How many people speak harshly? How many people speak cruelly? How many people speak in all kinds of ways which cause harm? And, I would assume that all of you are good people and don't do much of that. But you don't have to go very far in our world to see how much lying, cruelty, hostility gets expressed in speech. Some people live by it. Some people it happens under stress in times of difficulty. So if what you want to do is become free of suffering, it's very important to start paying attention to how you speak. Not moralistically. It's not like you have to kind of be a heavy moral thing here, but just a kind of pragmatic, ordinary, matter-of-fact kind of truth. That if you want to become free of suffering, don't speak in ways that cause suffering. Don't speak in ways that express suffering. Look at that. Now, some people are addicted to speaking. Some people get horrified any discussion about somehow modifying their speech or holding their tongue. And you see this very dramatically on the retreats that we teach. We do these longer retreats that are silent retreats. And there are some people who come on our meditation retreats who have never spent a day, or some of them are 10 days long, not talking to anybody. I mean, it's kind of inconceivable that you would spend 10 days of your life and not talk. And I've known people who've ran out of a retreat center screaming. Most people don't do that. Most people, by the end of the 10 days, love it and don't want to give it up. But this, the momentum of needing to speak is so strong that represents directly the strong attachment and clinging we have in our relationship to other people and how we represent ourselves and what we get in speech. It's one of the great trainings in life is to be able to be at peace with long periods of silence. It's a beautiful thing. So the path begins by looking at our speech. And a lot can happen there. And then how we behave is also very important. I mean, if you want to become free of suffering, you don't want to behave in ways that cause suffering. It's kind of like, you know, it's kind of obvious, right? So what the Buddha said, there are three things you want to avoid doing if your task is to become free of suffering. You should avoid killing, being involved in any kind of killing or intentional harming of other forms of life, other lives, other people. You should not steal. The way the Buddhists like to say it, because it's a higher kind of standard, is they don't say don't steal, they say don't take what is not given. So if it's not actually been offered to you, don't take it. And the third is don't be involved in sexual misconduct. And, you know, that's a place where there's so much suffering in this world of ours. It's something that touches people, their sexuality. Sexual relationships touches people in some of the deepest, heartfelt places they have, very vulnerable places. And so it causes, can cause, it's an arena that can cause a tremendous amount of pain that can ripple out way beyond the direct people involved. And so be careful with that, because that's a world of suffering or not, depending on how you behave with it. So be very careful with that sexual energy is one of the important things that, for this path, this freedom from suffering. And then there's right livelihood. Most people spend big chunks of their time, big percentage of their life, involved in something considered livelihood, a way of life. Even if you don't actually make a living on it, it's still a way of life. And then to have a livelihood that is in harmony with the approach of kindness, of compassion, of honesty, of not harming. Because if your livelihood harms, is dishonest, is cruel, you know, it's hard to imagine that you can actually start train yourself and transform yourself into a person who is, you know, free of those forces. It's very difficult sometimes to find work. Some people have spent a lot of time, but are struggling with that. I remember one man here who used to come to IMC. He was a machinist. And he worked for kind of a high-end, I guess, machinist shop. And he was doing great work in his shop. And then they got a contract from the Air Force of a foreign country that was involved in war to do something for their aircraft, for their fighter planes, you know, machine craft something. And so he went to his boss and he said, you know, I can't do this. I can't be involved in work that somehow supports a war effort somewhere in the world. And to the credit of his boss, the boss said, fine, you don't have to. It's nice, huh? So to give some care to our livelihood, because how we live our life that way will feed back and shape us and affect us. And so be careful how it shapes and affects our heart, our inner life. So we find a livelihood that actually shapes it in a useful and good way. There's too many people I meet who stumble on livelihood, a way of a career or something, that doesn't really have much meaning for them, except making money. And it's easy in that kind of situation to spend hours in work that doesn't really feed or nourish or help you walk the path. So the question comes back again to what do you most want? What's your deepest intention, your deepest wish in this life? If your deepest wish, if your wish around freedom from suffering is a mild one, yeah, I kind of like to suffer a little bit less, get through life a little bit nicer, smoother. You know, maybe then you don't have to do very change your life very much. But if you really want to get to the very root of your life, really kind of have this radical, deep transformation, where you really, what Buddhist tradition calls, you uproot the causes of all suffering in your life. It's a high order, requires a lot. You're under no obligation to do it. But if you're interested in doing that, then it really behooves you to look at all aspects of your life and see where do you have to make changes, sacrifices? You know, what do you have to really do to be able to kind of follow that all the way? You know, doesn't work so well to be fully motivated to become free, to become awakened, to be liberated, and only get around to it Sunday morning, or Monday evening at IMC. You know, it's nice, I hope, but you do it Monday evening at IMC practice, but, you know, if you really want to do it, you know, take it to the full potential you have, then the higher order of engagement is needed. So that has to do with our behavior. And the last steps of the Eightfold Path have to do with what goes on in our minds. And the first one is called right effort. And it's usually the wording of it is kind of complicated, so I won't give you the complicated classic wording and give you a simplified version of it. And that is, with your mind, with the activity of your mind, what goes on in your mind, it applies everywhere else too, but essentially here we're talking about the mind. Avoid doing those things that are harmful and do those things that are helpful. Isn't that nice? So that kind of comes down to that. So it means having a certain degree of mindfulness or capacity to track what's going on in your mind or in your heart, if you've heard that kind of language. So if you notice, for example, that you are angry with someone and you're spending a lot of time thinking about how lousy they are and all the different strategies of revenge, that's not helpful for you. It's not helpful for the process of your freedom. It's not helpful for that person. It probably doesn't serve you very well to do that. To have enough attention to notice, this is what I'm doing, and this is not helpful, is a very important form of mindfulness. And then to avoid doing that, enough of that. Or if you have certain activities, you've noticed that if you do them, they don't create a good state of mind for you. So, you know, if you're always going to horror movies or, you know, these violent action movies and you leave and you're always feeling kind of ready to, you know, you're ready for a rumble. Maybe that's okay to do that. If people like to rumble, you know. They can. But if what you want to do is become free of suffering, you know, you probably don't want to, you know, be looking for a fight. Or pornography. It might feel good at the moment, but how does it condition the mind to be involved in that and engaged in it? And it probably is not a very helpful state of mind to create. There's a whole series of things that you can, if you start looking and see, is this helpful for my state of mind? And then to take some responsibility for that, both for actions that do or don't create good states of mind, but also inner activities, what we think about, how we think, what we're focusing on, the feelings and emotions that we feed and fuel and act on. If we're feeling hostility, do we feed it? Do we stay involved in it? Do we identify with it? Or can we switch it to feeling kindness and compassion? Certain states of mind are helpful and some are not. One of the states of mind that's considered very helpful to cultivate and develop is mindfulness. Another state that's considered very helpful to cultivate is concentration, or calm, stable, focused mind. And one of the things that Buddhism, as Buddhist practice, is predicated on is that the human mind, or the heart if you prefer, is not a thing, but a process, or series of processes. And because it's not a fixed thing, it's not like the solid brain that just doesn't, you know, the mind is a process. The mind is not the brain. The mind is a process within the brain, in a sense. These processes can be shaped. And anybody who knows that, who learns a skill, learns a musical instrument or a craft or a sport, that you can learn something, you can change. And the process of how the mind functions is plastic, is malleable. And so Buddhism takes this principle of the malleability of the mind and takes it very seriously and begins to train the mind, cultivate the mind. And one of the really important ways of cultivating it is to cultivate its capacity for being mindful, for being attentive, to pay careful attention. And any of you who meditate, I'm sure, I'm talking to the experts now, you're all experts at how easy it is for the mind not to pay attention. You sit down, okay, I'm going to sit here for 40 minutes and pay attention to my breath. And then at the end of 40 minutes, wow, I mostly didn't. And so to be able to develop the mindfulness and concentration, to develop it and train oneself so you have a higher and higher capacity to be mindful and attentive to what's going on, is a really important part of this path. And that's the seventh and eighth steps of the Eightfold Path, right mindfulness and right concentration. As the mindfulness and concentration becomes stronger, it loops back to the first step of the Eightfold Path. We have a greater heightened attention and capacity to look carefully at our suffering, at the Four Noble Truths and how it works. We have a greater capacity to take some greater control or greater choice around the attitude we have, how we live our life. We can call forth more kindness and compassion. We have then greater choice also of how we act in the world, how we speak and how we act, because we see more what's going on. We see the places of choice. And that feeds to a greater, you know, as we focus more on our behavior, living more wisely, that feeds into a greater capacity for mindfulness, developing the mind, concentration. So it's kind of becomes a spiral, a loop that supports each other and grows and grows. As this gets stronger and stronger, this loop, at some point it feeds back again to the beginning, Four Noble Truths. And we see the Four Noble Truths, we see practically, realistically, how this really works in the depths of our psyche. And at some point we can see right down to the very bottom of our psyche, our mind, our heart, and see some of the deepest and most subtle places where we cling to and uproot them. It's kind of like looking down at the very cornerstone of the whole edifice of self, of belief structure, of clinging that we have, and pull the rug from under it, pull the cornerstone out, so all this can crumble and fall away. Not to live in ruins afterwards, but rather to live in peace, to live without the armor, to live without all the defenses, to live without all this, you know, delusion that we build up around ourselves. So so what happened, it was very interesting that happens then, that as we become more mature, more developed, and more in the Eightfold Path, slowly the Eightfold Path stops being something we train ourselves in, but rather becomes something we are. So rather than training in honesty, we become honest. Rather than training in friendliness, we become friendly. Rather than training in compassion, we become compassionate. Rather than training in becoming mindful, we are mindful. Rather than training in becoming concentrated, we are concentrated. And so with time, the idea is the Eightfold Path becomes not something that becomes cultivated, but it's something that really expresses our maturity. In Buddhist language, talk about expresses our realization. And so it becomes who you are more than something that you do. And in this spirit, it isn't something. It isn't like you're taking on something externally. It isn't like the Eightfold Path is this external kind of system. But it has a lot to do with shedding all the things that are extra, all the clinging that is extra, all the attachments that are extra, that cover over the goodness, the purity of the mind, of the heart, and the clarity, the peacefulness of the heart. And when the heart's at peace, when the heart is clear, then it becomes a natural thing to live in harmony with these eight steps, with right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So, for those of you who came all 4 weeks, I hope that this made some sense to you. For those of you who only came today, I think I gave a much more impassioned talk than the last three. Hope it didn't turn you off. But really kind of pointing to something that is really profoundly beautiful and valuable. And I hope that one way or the other, that the wisdom of these teachings becomes something that you personalize for yourself. And in doing so, helps you live at peace in this life. May your fires be extinguished and become cool. Thank you so much.